Boom. All right. Excellent. Okay. So, all right, everybody. I am here today with Chris Duffin. Chris is the owner of Kabuki Strength, which is a very innovative company creating tools and methods and education to help people create strength. And I use that term specific, for a very specific reason, because I like the way that Chris talks about defined strengths. I'm going to have him talk about that. But I appreciate you taking the time to share some knowledge with us today.
Looking forward to it. So I've been looking forward to this conversation since we met a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Awesome, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was a very interesting and powerful, meeting, if you want to call it that, because you presented at the Joel Jameson weekend workshop or seminar, which was a great time in itself. And your presentation was one that I was definitely looking forward to, because I'd seen some of your soft tissue mobilization methods before. And like a lot of people, I'd really kind of had my questions as to how effective they were compared to some of the things that I had been doing. And so you had come up and I was playing around with I forget which one of the tools. What's the big one? Not the boomstick, but the 44-pound one.
That one's the pain pill.
The pain pill, yes. I was playing around with the pain pill on my forearms, and you came over and showed me some stuff that made it even more painful. But when I stood up, I could feel a definite difference in my forearms and muscle tightness. And for anyone who knows me, a lot of people know I've got bad elbows. I've talked about it before. I've jacked my elbows up riding mountain bikes multiple times. And just got arthritis in them, don't have full range of motion. I've jokingly called them my elbows. So when what you showed me, the difference that it made, it really got me like, whoa, I haven't really experienced a whole lot of things that made that big of a difference that quickly. And so I know I'm kind of like rambling on here a little bit, but I'm just excited about what kind of the impact that it made. Because I've really struggled with keeping my elbows feeling good, because I do jiu-jitsu as well. So it's just a terrible combination. But I usually have to use like CBD cream and some other things to keep my elbows feeling good. And I realized the other day, since I'd gotten back, and especially since I got my boomstick in the mail and I've been doing some of the stuff that you showed me, that I haven't been using that stuff. My elbows feel great. And I've been really excited to get you on to share this stuff with riders, because there's a lot of riders who are dealing with pain that I think that your guys' method and approach can help with. But with all that said, I guess just give us a little bit of a background. You know, who is Chris Duffin, and you know what makes what you have. To say, you know, why would a mountain biker, I guess, necessarily be interested in how what a lot of people would define as a power lifter? You know, why would they be interested in what you had to say? So, it from there, man.
Well, powerlifting has been something I've done as a hobby, right? Well, I guess maybe at a professional level, whatever you call it. But I've got a lot of experience training, and 30 years of training, actually. And which doesn't give me, a huge point there, but with Kabuki Strength, with owning my own gym, there's some things and philosophy standpoints that we stand behind. And a lot of it, you know, people think it's just like lifting heavy, and it's not. We're a biomechanics company. We focus on improving spinal position and management, joint positions. Like, everything that we do is around essentially improving sports performance. And so as a company, we work directly with, there's probably not a professional sport out there that you can list that we don't work within. So we consult and work with nearly all the top Major League Baseball teams. We work in the NFL. We've got Tour de France teams using our stuff. By the way, our soft tissue stuff, have been in one of the Tour de France teams for a couple of years. Now you can kind of see why. Olympian throwers, track and field, MBA, the list goes on and on. And we work on both education and the equipment side and then the soft tissue stuff. So we're really unique and innovative in that manner. And my personal background is actually engineering. So I ran for about 20 years, ran engineering teams, then ended up running companies in the aerospace and automotive fields. And at the same time, owned a gym and was competing as an athlete, essentially at the top of my game there. So I was ranked number one in the world for 8 years straight. I still hold the Guinness World Record for the largest sumo deadlift ever done. I'm the only person, any weight, any condition that's ever repped, done 1,000 pounds for reps. Lots of things like that. And I do a lot of feats of strength that actually go beyond just lifting big, right? It's about being able to recover and being able to manage those stressors, like squatting 800 pounds every single day for 30 days. That's one of them. I've done a few things like that. And so you've got to have all this stuff dialed in. And so I've taken that engineering mindset and with my, you know, with my own gym, with my own training and trying to dive deeper. And one of the things I learned a long time ago was you can be the smartest guy, you know, think you're the smartest guy in the room, but there's so much to learn from everyone else. And so a number of years ago, I started networking and trying to find, you know, I had injuries creeping up. Guess what? That's what's going to happen when you've been lifting for as long as I have at the level I was. And started networking and developing relationships a little bit more on the clinical side of things. So I started doing a lot of basically clinical-based coursework. And so I developed a network of friends that are literally the best in the world as far as mobility, you know, the best physical therapist, the best spine biomechanist, one of the best orthopedic surgeons in the world. Like, the list goes on. These are the, if you go to our advisory board, you'll see a number of them. There's a lot more than that. The people that stand behind the products and methodology that we do. And over the course of that, developed kind of pulled together, you know, all these different philosophy points and into a singular kind of principle-based system that we have around human movement under load. And load could be really anything. Load is your bicycle pedal, right? Going up a hill or down a hill against your arms and shoulders, right?
Yeah.
But it's really anything that's going to apply a stress to the body and be more than, because again, a lot of the places I was working off of from a research standpoint were working with like sedentary, older population individuals. And so we had to spend years kind of pulling these things together for an athletic population, right? And so a lot of work that we work around is basically improving fundamental movement patterns. We have a lot of stuff based off of developmental kinesiology that we work with. We've got an entire website for corrective, we call it skill-based work, but basically corrective exercises that's used in some physical therapy colleges and end users, and it's a great resource. But the gap on the soft tissue side was something that we wanted to address as well. I saw a lot of people out there just, you know, foam rolling that IT band over, you know, every single workout, every year over year, and just not really making any progress, right? I just use that as an example because that's one of the most common things you'll see walking into a, you know, a warm-up area of a gym, right? And so, yeah, that's I kind of prefacing this towards the soft tissue side of the discussion, because I know that's where you wanted to spend some time on today. But that's who we are as Kabuki. We make incredibly innovative products that get us in better positions and allow us to move better and express and develop resilience and become stronger, which is going to allow us to be able to go do things and not get injured. If you're stronger and more resilient, you're going to reduce those injury rates and allow you to do the things that you want to do. And so that's what we do at Kabuki. We're an education company first. And the output of all of our products, soft tissue tools, training tools, all that is all gaps that we see out there based on the principles that we believe in. And that's why we when we come to market with things, they're things that nobody's seen before. And they take education, they take explanation. They take people looking at it going, well, why is that any different than what I've been doing, right? Until you use it and you go, oh, yeah. Okay, what you're saying was real. Like, yes, it was real. But it takes a little while, you know, because it's new, it's different. It's, you know, people haven't seen it and they don't really realize it really is very different. The results that you can get with, you know, minor changes and tweaks and understanding more of a systematic approach to things.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I'm glad you mentioned that you're, you know, besides powerlifting, you also have an endurance side to what you do with the squatting, the, you know, 880 pounds every day for 30 days. Like that is, it's not just walking out there one day and doing it. It's being able to do it the next day and do it the next day.
And that's exactly what I'm trying to demonstrate, because it's one thing, like you said, just to walk out there and be strong enough to do it. There's tons of people at that level. There's literally no one else in the world that could do what I just did. People stronger than me, they can't do that, you know, because you've got to be able to, one, move really well. You've got to quickly assess and address things, because you start getting something, you know, a little bit of pain building up, and all of a sudden you're just going to get a train wreck's going to hit you, because the next day you're squatting 800. And of course, you're not squatting 800. You're also squatting 700 and 600, 500 and 400 and every single day, right?
Yeah.
So I really like challenges like that, because it takes everything to be able to pull that off.
Yeah. No, you definitely have to. One of the things that, especially with mountain bikers, I try to get them to understand is that a lot of it comes down to managing tension, and mountain biking creates a lot of tension in the body, especially the upper body, compared to like road riding. And so knowing how to manage that tension is a huge aspect of it, which again was really drew me to what you guys were doing. I love you had a saying that you need to do the stuff today to earn the right to train tomorrow. And that really hit home, because that is such an important thing, especially for people that, you know, mountain bikers that don't want to be held back. Like they don't want to not be able to ride tomorrow because of their ride today, and why the stuff that you guys are doing, I think, has such a important impact on that.
Yeah. I just get frustrated with the people that wait till that last minute. It's like, I'm warming up and I've got these issues and I got to deal with it so I can get out there and do my thing. I'm like, well, why didn't you do that yesterday or the day before or after your last training session? Like, you got to earn your right to do this, not do it at the last minute and cobble together something so you can get on, in your instance, get on the trail and, you know, try to work through some pain to get it done.
Yeah. No doubt. So, you touched on this a little bit, but how do you define the word strength?
So strength is life. strength is adapting to stress. This is the human condition. This is how we grow and live, is we have applied stresses and we adapt to that stress and we become a stronger, better version of ourselves. You could walk down the line of epigenetics or things like that with the discussion if you want. And it doesn't matter what the, you know, philosophically, you know, this is physical stress, mental stress, emotional stress, like all of this stuff. And we need those stresses actually in our life. So there's a balance. You've got to be able to recover, because if you sat there, you know, riding your bike 12 hours a day, every single day, a couple weeks in, you're not going to be able to adapt anymore, right? So your accumulation of fatigue is going to be accumulating faster than your adaptation from those stressors. So there's always a balance of that. But when we quit stressing ourselves, everybody knows, if you quit going to the gym, what happens? The process of atrophy. Okay? That is the start of, you know, again, death, right? We're atrophying. We're no longer growing. We're becoming soft. We're like, so to me, like, the pursuit of strength is the pursuit of life. And, you know, maybe we don't all agree here. You know, some people want to seek comfort and whatever in their life, but that's not my audience and not my beliefs. So that's a really important thing. And strength as a whole is our resilience, being able to develop the resilience to handle those stressors. Okay. If you become stronger physically, mentally, you know, emotionally, you're going to be able to, you know, take those things that come at you sideways. Okay. You know, you're going down a mountain and you take a quick turn and something's in the way and all of a sudden you're jarred and have to do something that you didn't expect. Just like taking a crash. If you take a crash and you don't have any set of shoulder strength, you may blow your shoulder completely out, right?
Yeah.
You don't have the resilience to withstand that impact, right? And same thing in all the rest of your life around, you know, you're not going to be able to take the criticism from a boss on a Friday, you know, or whatever it is, you know, we've got to be seeking and finding those things so that we can develop the resilience. And make better versions of ourselves. So,
yeah, no, that's awesome. I love too. You guys got the anti-fragile term thrown in. I love that book. That's a book I reference often in my own thinking and my stuff on the podcast. I love that philosophical side because we require stress. And if you try to protect yourself too much, you actually, when things break, they break horribly. And
you eat a perfect diet, everything, just no stressors, no whatever, like all the time. And then you get to be 50 years old and you have a big fatty burger and you freaking keel over and have a heart attack, you know, like your body doesn't know how to deal with all that.
That dealing with the stress side and growing from the stress side. I like too that you guys, that you define strength separate than numbers. I think that I actually have an article on why I don't really like the term strength training, because people start to think that like the numbers are the goal, when really if you're doing the right things, like you're moving better, your mindset's better, your recovery is better, the side effect is that you move more weight. But if your focus is just moving more weight, come hell or high water, you can miss some of these other elements that are going to lead to you breaking down sooner or holding back your progress down the road. So remembering that it's more than just a number on the bar, although that number has meaning, it's not the focus, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yep. There's a term we use a lot called there's always more. You can always dig deeper. You can always do more. But more doesn't mean another 5 pounds on the bar. It means, could I be bracing better? Could I be moving better? Can I have more purpose and, you know, with what I'm doing? Like, there's so many aspects. We should always be driving. There's always more. But it doesn't necessarily mean putting 5 pounds on the bar, right?
Right. So. Yes. Yeah. It's that pursuit of mastery. Knowing it's that asymptote, right? Like, we'll never quite touch it. But we want to get as close as we can. And every rep holds a lesson that if you use that, if you learn it and you apply it to the next one, and like, yeah, that's, you know, yeah. No, I love that, man. It is. It's a philosophy. Strength is a philosophy. It's not just a number on the bar. So, I really like that about what you guys are doing. So what Kabuki Strength, I have to ask, what is behind the name? I'm familiar with the name Kabuki. Kabuki theater from old samurai Japan, and so I'm just kind of wondering the relevance with what you guys are doing.
We do have a fair bit of Japanese philosophy mixed in. That's one thing that I worked when I worked in, you know, the industrial sector. I did a lot with some Japanese based philosophy around operations and management principles. So that's always been an ongoing theme. But for us, we have this, we call it our squat face. And it's this rendition of, you know, it's a kabuki mask of, you know, like somebody squatting really hard, right? And so, you know, we say, get your squat face on. And Kabuki Strength's going to apply the equipment and the methods. But at the end of the day, you're the one that's got to bring the mental attitude. You got to put your game day face on and become a different version of your, you know, self. Maybe a different version, but uh, it's you know, when to really push yourself, you got to be something different. And so like that kabuki mask, it's known for theater. You put it on and you're going out and acting and presenting something. It can also be that mask that a warrior put on. And you see this a lot in tons of cultures, this like before going to battle, this face painting or mask type thing. And it's because literally that person has to become somebody different. You have to become different than the husband, the father, the you know, the caregiver, to somebody that's going to go out and do like some bad thing, you know, some horrible things, to be able to protect, you know, their community, their family, and all these things. And the only way that you can do that is just become somebody different, right? And so anyway, it's just about that last aspect. I can talk philosophy, I can try to talk this stuff into you, but at the end of the day, you're the one that's got to put your game day face on. And we'll give you everything else, but you own that.
No, there's a saying, I forget where I got it from, but like, words can lead you to the start of the path, but they can't walk the path for you. So, and there's so many people out there that just keep looking for the right words to walk that path for them. And it's like, man, we'll get you there, but you got to start walking that path. It's your freaking spot. And I like that.
And that's what I wrote my recent book about, was to help with that. Because with Kabuki, we don't play in that arena, right? I've got my own philosophy and things. Obviously, to perform at the level I have, you know, you've got to be able to draw on those things. You know, just a brief plug about my book, The Eagle and the Dragon. You can find it on Amazon, Audible, Barnes and Noble, and all that. But really powerful book to help you put these tools together in your business life, your personal life, just all those aspects of the pieces I don't touch on with Kabuki, those mental, you know, emotional and even spiritual aspects. And so it's a really great piece that helps people explore and try to understand what they're asking the questions, to do a deeper dive and understanding what your values in life are. And then from that, being able to work into developing goals that are going to help you realize a life that with those values, and then providing you some practical tools to be able to execute that and make it a reality. And so anyway, check it out if you have a chance. But
yeah, no, The Eagle and the Dragon, I just finished reading it. I was about halfway through it when I met you at Joel's, and so finished reading it. And yeah, no, exactly like you're saying, it's a really powerful story. The lessons that you kind of tie it into and the tools that you give people are great. I mean, that's another thing I tell clients, like, man, we got to get you fixed from the neck up. Like, from the neck down is easy, easy. Like, but we got to get that neck up fixed. And so, you know, those things that you talk about, in there, you know, those are like those big picture things. Like, you can have the best training program in the world, but man, if your values are off, if your energy is going in the wrong directions, it's not gonna be sustainable. And I guess that's kind of thing. I think we're the same age. I'm 43, and so, you know, you're early 40s. If I'm not
42 for a little bit longer. Yep.
Okay. Cool. Excellent. It's one of those things you start to really appreciate when you get a few decades of training under your belt. Like, sustainability is such a huge aspect of it. And so getting that mindset right. So yeah, I definitely recommend your book. I thought it was a really great tool for people in that arena. But gotta get the mind right, folks. Get the mind right.
You wanna jump into soft tissue concepts and stuff?
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly what I want to jump into here. So, soft tissue, work. I mean, what role in the big picture would you say that soft tissue plays in the role of training?
So there's a couple different ways, that we're going to speak to this, and then talk about, basically all the different ways, cause people kind of lump it all together as like just one thing, like, oh, you got to do your foam rolling or whatever it is. And there's a lot of different pieces that are happening for you to decide what type of approach to take. So the first one is, if you're doing it from a I need to fix something standpoint, like I'm hurt, I'm or I'm something is sore. I consider that more of like a triage type application. Like it's, you're trying to remedy a problem. And so just to be straight up and honest, 80% of those problems are a result of your poor programming. Okay. It means that you're having either, you know, spikes in volume from one week to the next, exceed a threshold that'll end up leading to injuries. You could dive into Tim Gabbett's work if you want to. I'm not going to spend too much time on it here. Or you're moving poorly, which is typically about the other 20%. Again, referencing Tim Gabbett's work. So it means the fix isn't doing the work. That's going to get you back to it. But if you keep having to work on the same issue 6 months from now, you got to really dive in and try to go, okay, what is going on? Okay. Now, the other side of this is performance enhancement. Okay. So if I can do more work in a given period of time, then I'm going to be able to have a more response and become stronger, over the period of time. Again, let me cover a little bit of Tim's research first. So we have what's called chronic load and acute loading. Chronic loading would be your average training volume, and this would include your cycling, any all your physical activity over a multiple month period of time. Acute loading would be your volume within a specific week. So if you're spiking training loads beyond 10 to 15% as acute loading over your chronic loading, your average loading, I like using that, you know, it's a little more descriptive. That's where the problems are going to counter. Not necessarily the week that you do that or the week after. A lot of times it's about 4 or 5 weeks later. All of a sudden you'll creep up and like, my knee's sore, you know, what's going on here? Quads tight. So those are the problems. Now, how we improve over time is those acute spikes, if we keep them at 10% or under, we're going to be able to manage that. And every time we spike the acute loads, what do? We move up our average or chronic training load, right? So if I'm able to improve my recovery times, then I can have a better chance of moving those chronic loads up, which is then going to give me the ability to ride longer and harder, okay, on a more frequent basis, which is what we want to do, okay? So now I'm going to jump back and talk about more of the triage type work, the stuff that I've got a problem and I'm hurt, okay? I fucked up my training loads. I jumped out. I took 3 weeks off from training, and I went out to make up for it and said, I'm going to go ride 100 miles. You know, I don't know if that's a lot. I'd have to. my chief engineer is actually a downhill cyclist, competitive as well. I'd have to go ask him. But anyway, or you. Anyway, I'm going to go do a whole lot more to make up for it, right? Well, because of the 3 weeks off, you just lowered your average, you know, your chronic training load, and then you had a huge spike. Okay. So sometime in the next month, you potentiated. Doesn't mean you're going to have an injury, but you potentiated your injury risk. Okay. So now that's happened. So we've got to understand there's several different. So when we're doing soft tissue work, we are not actually physically manipulating or breaking up adhesions. We're not stretching fascia. None of this physical nature of it is actually happening. It's all neurology. So we're sending signals to the brain to say, hey, it's safe to relax and be able to work in this, you know, in this range of motion now. And then it sends a signal back, and then those changes then happen. Okay. If we understand that, then it helps us understand how to use and implement the tools a little bit better. So we've got deep neurology. So that's like deep in the muscle tendons or in the muscle bellies. Okay. That's going to be stuff where we're going to apply deep. That's going to be like the head of the boomstick driven in. That's going to be your classical ART. So we're going to go into that tissue. Okay. Usually, and we cover it in the rule of three. So one end of the muscle, the opposing end, and somewhere in the middle. And then we're going to move that muscle through its range of motion while we've got this load applied in there. Our tools work differently. One, because they're metal. They don't give, the body can sense, if we understand now that it's a neurological thing. If I'm pushing into it with something soft, it might be fighting back versus an unforgiving thing. The other is being able to disperse that load. If I go in there and it hurts, like if I go in there with my thumb or all the other sharp tools out there, I'm going to get that pullback response, which again is, well, there's also a chemical response and other stuff going on there. But with our tools, we've got this larger radius and it allows you to get in there deep and then stay in there for a longer period of time that you wouldn't be able to do with your hands or a lot of tools out there or foam rolling. Once you've like anybody that's an athlete, like I don't feel a damn thing from it. Like it just, it does not get into that deep, doesn't do anything. Like it's not enough. Maybe for some grandma or something like that. I don't know. none of the grandmas I work with though. it allows us to stay in there for a longer period of time. Again, it's not long, 60, 90 seconds, and move that tissue through a range of motion. Okay. Now, next up, we've got superficial and peripheral neurology. This is at the cutaneous level, the skin below, beneath the skin, and also nerves within the fascia as well, which is the next layer down below that. So that's going to be affected by more of the shearing type work. So that's going to be where we're going to grab the boomstick or the geisha and actually twist it one direction or the other, grabbing those skin layers and pulling and trying to separate that tissue. And usually we'll do some movement with that as well. More of an opening, closing type floss. Think of like a flossing type work where we're basically we're not stretching the fascia. It's a fixed thing through the whole body, but we can actually pull it one direction or another underneath that through with our movement. Okay. And again, we're going to be getting those signals. Hey, it's safe to play. All of a sudden you're going to see dramatic changes in your movement capacity. Okay. That's also going to be like, usually what's being done with a lot of like Graston or scraping type work. We've got some products like that as well. You can technically get into the deep work with those tools as well. Found that it's typically not what most practitioners are doing anymore with those tools, just because they're a little sharp on the skin and stuff and start pushing in that heavy, it can be difficult. We don't get as good a results as using our boomstick, pain pills, those type of tools, with that deeper neurology. the performance aspect. So the performance aspect is going to be to help with blood flow. Improving blood flow, improving lymphatic drainage. So the lymphatic system is like the largest organ in the body. If you want to check out Dr. Perry Nicholson's work, Stop Chasing Pain on Instagram, he's got some fantastic stuff. What we would do there is, actually you get some of the lymphatic drainage with that shearing type work as well. I can stimulate that. But is a slow pass roll. So this would be like post-session, I'm going to take one of those tools and do like a 2-minute slow wave of pressure from one end to the other. Okay. And that's going to be one that enhances that recovery modality. So you can now try to stack the next session in because you're going to recover a little bit quicker, right? That could be done after training, the next day off, those sorts of things. Okay. So those are like the primary ways that we use those tools. And I've got some theories on, why they work more effectively than other methods, but it's incredible. We just know that they do. We don't have research backing it. I can tell you theories. At the end of the day, it's made up, stuff, in my head. We do know for a fact it does deliver different results. Like I can take somebody that gets, there's a good video when I first came out with the boomstick. I worked with a professional bodybuilder and who was also like, held the all-time world record in powerlifting at the same time. And he'd retired from lifting. He couldn't raise his hand over his shoulder. Hadn't bench pressed in 2 years because even the barbell taking it to his chest caused him pain, right? So I worked on him with a boomstick for a few minutes and restored entire range of motion so he could get his hand over his arms overhead. He walked over to the bench pressed the bar, went, oh, I don't feel anything. Ended up loading up 5 plates, 500 pounds, and hitting some reps for it. 3 weeks later, this is a guy, by the way, that was seeing an ART practitioner every single week. He was doing active recovery every other day. Like, he's a really smart, he's got all the resources. This is his job. It's not like he wasn't doing the work. 3 weeks later, I text him, like, how you doing? He's like, man, he's like, still feeling great. And the best thing is, my wife's so happy I can actually put the dishes away after end of the coverage above the sink. He's like, that's the big win.
Nice.
He's older. He's about 50 or so, you know, he's not really worried about what he bench presses anymore.
Right.
But that's the thing, like, because if we go in with these other sharper tools and other methods, like, what we see is typically you go get a massage therapy, and I still get massage therapy done. A lot of times we're using our tools when we do it here. But, you know, if I need a restored range of motion, it's going to last for 45 minutes, maybe 2 days if I'm lucky. Usually it's gone by the next day for sure. If we open somebody up and restore range of motion with these tools, and we've got education on how to do it on, you know, basically for all the different joints, it's going to last for weeks. Okay. And that's just incredible. And you experienced it.
Yeah.
Until you experience it firsthand, it's kind of hard to believe. But it's really powerful stuff. The other thing with that, when we restore range of motion too, so this goes on the performance side, right? If I've got restricted muscles and I've got one pulling tight, let's say my quads are tight and it's pulling my pelvis forward, okay? I can go train, I can go ride, I can go do all these things, right? But from a performance aspect, one, I'm compromising my spinal position, so that's going to throw me into extension with the spine, which then is going to again, if I'm bent over a bike, that's going to compound even more because I'm going to be in flexion through the thoracic and cervical areas of the spine, right? And so you've got this huge amount of tension through there. That's not good to begin with, but let's just focus on the muscles' power in the pedals, right? So I've got those quads pulled and shortened. I've got the psoas lengthened. I've got the hamstring lengthened. So this is where muscle length tension relationships come into play. So there's an optimal, if you go do a curl and you go into a full extended position versus pulling the weight up to where it's in the mid range and try to curl, you're going to feel the difference in power output in all different areas through that range of motion. So when we start shifting joints, well, joints is probably the wrong term, but when we start affecting those muscle length tension relationships, we're going to definitely be affecting output as well. And there's a whole lot of other chain of stuff we could kind of discuss down that route. I probably need to grab one of my people that specialize in that area to use all the scientific terms. But you can see how that comes into play, right? I mean, that's going to affect those tight quads. Those tight quads are going to be affecting nearly everything we've just talked. It's going to be taking everything from the neck flexors all the way down through the knee is going to be affected by that. If we're not able to get those released and moved back into their normal length, okay? That's going to affect our breathing patterns, our ability to stabilize. the long-term effects from that, again, that's a couple-day seminar for us, is really huge. And this is important stuff to understand, especially in the cycling world, because you guys, every sport is like this. This isn't knocking cycling. Like Olympic weightlifters get in a horrible position at the bottom of a snatch, like that, you know, like there's a compromises for every sport, right?
Yeah.
In cycling, you know that you got to take care of those shoulders, the upper back, spine, you know, your lumbar spine, like all this stuff gets eaten up really bad being in those positions for long periods of time with all that tension in it, right?
Yeah.
Like you've got to take care of that if you want to realize, one, both reduce that potentiation of injury, because again, I'm not going to say it's going to injure you, but the risk is definitely heightened, and I'm sure you being in the sport can probably say that, see that in a lot of people. But your performance is going to be compromised if you're not doing the work to stay on top of this stuff.
Yeah, no, that's
Yeah, sorry, that was a little bit of a long rant, but
no, man, that was great. I was loving it, man. I was just taking some mental notes on that. But yeah, man, you touched on a lot of stuff. I think that you know, just my own personal philosophy in thinking about stuff. I think that when a lot of people start foam rolling, they're so freaking tight that it hurts, and it does something at first. But the thing is, it doesn't.
And here's another thing. So if we think about the neurology aspect, again, this is a little bit of theory, but this is about as solid a theory as you can.
Because
we're talking about relaxing the nerve, you know, sending signals to the body to say, relax, it's safe to play in this range of motion. So we're trying to be in the, you know, one, that's why we move the arm through those ranges or the move the muscles through those ranges while we've got the pressure applied. But on the foam roller, you're up on it and you're controlled and tight through the whole, you're just like you're on your bike, right?
Yeah.
You still have all this tension through the body trying to control and then mash out this tissue over here and get it to say, oh no, it's safe to relax, right? That's the value of having the weight in the tool as well, to be able to, you lay down and it's doing the work on you, right? You are going to get a completely different neurological response from that. Right? Yeah. I don't see how you could argue otherwise.
No, I totally agree.
So again, that's why I wanted to cover that, fundamentally, the best that we know that's happening when we're doing this type of work. Again, there's a lot of questions out there on what is actually happening during soft tissue work, but that is the current, understanding that's happening, is that there's actually no physical changes. It's all neurological that's driving that.
Yeah.
And so once we, it helps grasp these things. Oh yeah, of course it's going to be different if I'm rolling a heavy weight on my quad while I'm laying down and then actively moving it through range of motion versus having tension through my whole body while I try to mash that out, right?
Yeah, an active plank basically while you're trying to
exactly
roll out your quad. Yeah. So the tools, you guys have a lot of tools, or not a lot, I guess you guys have several tools for this. The one that you suggested that I start with was the boomstick, which is a long metal cylinder. Was about 2 feet.
Just shy of 2 feet. Yep.
In about just under 20 pounds. And it is, got knurling in the center for actually gripping the skin and doing some of that superficial work like you're talking about. And then the weight and the end of it is big enough to disperse it like you're talking about, so that when you're pushing in, it's not painful, which again, I think is very important. And so it's a great tool. And then you also have one you call the Geisha or the ex-wife because it weighs like 200 pounds. I got the joke. It's something that you can fill up to several hundred pounds, right?
Yeah. So the current model, you fill it with concrete once you get it. That way it keeps the shipping weight down. We are switching the later half of this year, probably the next couple months, switching over to a plate loaded version. Because once you put the concrete in it, it is whatever weight it is. So if you fill it the standard way, it comes out 130 pounds. Some people will put, if they've got multiple, they'll put steel, you know, like some extra plates or scrap, whatever, into the concrete mix. And that can drive the weight up to over 200 pounds. But we're going to switch to a plate loadable version with a more smooth cutout to disperse the load over like the quads and other areas, because you're usually doing bigger muscles when you're doing that. So it's... Yeah. It's kind of rounded in the shape of a quad, basically, in the center of it. And then that allows you also, if you're rolling someone's back out, where the center of it won't be touching the spinous process, which is our current design still has the cutout for the spinous process, because I didn't want to put a product on the market that could be putting some pressure on that. So.
Yeah, for sure. So those tools, I guess, what would be the easiest to start incorporating, you know, one or both of these tools? Like, how would you suggest they start incorporating them into their training or riding?
So yeah, we've got a couple other ones there too. So we have the 44-pound pain pill. It's mm-hmm. got a little bit bigger radius on there as well, about the same length as the boomstick. And then we've got the baby boomer, which is a little 6-pound one that can go in your gym bag. It's easy to travel with because you can travel with even in your checked bag, as long as it's under 8 pounds of steel, you can put it in your carry-on. A boomstick you gotta put in your, you know, gotta put in your checked bag, that sort of stuff. But the most versatile, so the pain pill is absolutely great for like larger tissue, maybe cutting down, like if I go into the glutes, instead of hitting three different spots, I can hit one spot with it. The most versatile is the boomstick. So I recommend people start with the boomstick and then add an AccuMobility ball. So this is basically a half a lacrosse ball. It's got a few more features than that, but they're really amazing. And you can ramp up the pressure by doing what we call the vice technique. And that would be putting the AccuMobility ball on the opposite side of the, so you'd set it on the ground. And then you basically pin the muscle between that and the boomstick. And we have videos on all this through the entire body on the product pages. So you don't have to worry about figuring this stuff out. We walk through all of it. I've got, we also have a bunch of assessment videos where we walk through like, oh, here's how you would find the problem. Like here, you see this problem in someone's movement. Here's where we would look. And this is what we would do. The bunch of those, they're longer. They're on YouTube. They're a little bit, they're usable for anyone, but it's me and the owner of AccuMobility, and they're kind of like clinical assessments. So they're like 20 to 45 minute long videos, but they're really great. And then we've got a bunch of just short ones on how to use the boomstick, vice technique. Actually, we just shot a whole new series on the vice technique, working through the whole body in like 2 to 5 minute segments for each part of the body. So a boomstick and an AccuMobility ball is like so powerful because you can actually ramp up the intensity. So if the weight's not enough, the AccuMobility ball will ramp it up for you by pinning the tissue. So it allows you to use one or both of them together and get a lot more out of it.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's great advice. And then, is this something you would say people should do every day or just on days they train? Like what's your kind of take on doing this type of work?
Yeah. So that's a good question. The best goal would be you never have to use it. I know I'm not a very good salesman, right? But if you're moving well and your programming's perfect, you're not going to need this stuff. Now, the reality is that's not usually the case 100% of the time. And so we have these tools to deal with those outliers. So I just really want to make that point because if you're sitting there and using it every day for the same issue month over month, go figure out your damn problem. Okay. Yeah. So you might need some help because you're not figuring out how to fix it. So maybe see somebody to help assess or look at your programming, look at your movement. Like this is where the stuff's going to be. Okay. We can use it as a performance tool though, too, as well. So my favorite approach is using this immediately post session. And that's challenging for some people. If I've developed some sort of issue, you know, from some tightness that came out in sort of that session, try to clean it up so I'm moving and feeling well the longest period as possible. Or doing some of that work the day before a training session, like do a little bit of assessment, do some movement drills and go, I'm missing some internal or external rotation or whatever it is. Clean it up so the next day I don't have to do that. A lot of people still default to doing it right before training. Okay. And I guess that's just life. You know, it's not, we don't have the luxury of calling this sort of stuff our job for most of us. Right. So you got to fit it in. the recovery, the performance aspect, you would do that post session. Definitely. It doesn't have to be like immediate, but like sometime in that day, that the closer you get it, the better. But sometime in that period, doing those slow pass rolls and stuff like that is definitely going to enhance your performance. So there really isn't any fixed hard rules, honestly. Yeah. I just try to make some key points because so no matter how many times I see it, people, the tools feel great once you use them, and you just like keep going. I'll just that's the answer to everything. And, you know, I want people to dig deeper, and I want them to resolve root cause problems and not just work on, you know, dealing with cleanup work afterwards. That's just basically the point I'm trying to make. You can't really go wrong with any way of implementing it, honestly. It's, yeah.
No, man, that's good advice. I think that definitely post-workout is good advice, because, like you said, I think a lot of people just think of using this stuff pre-workout. And so
if you're going into a workout or a ride or whatever and you can't get a joint in a good position, you need to do it right then.
Yeah.
You can't overhead press without doing this, because otherwise you're going to be in massive extension. You're going to cause more problems through the body, right? Like, you can't, like, so that is definitely a hard, fast rule. Like, if you go to, it's game day, it's training day, and you're not able to get in the positions that you need to be in, go fix it, like, right now. But get away from having to do that. So
No, I think that's a good point. Like, the goal is to not need it. You know, use it if you need it, but don't use it as a crutch, because you're not doing the other things that you should be doing away from training to kind of help with that. So I think that's you know, good advice there. So yeah, that's I think all the questions I had kind of on the soft tissue side. I think that again, just, you know, really encouraging people to check out your guys' website at kabukistrength.com and check out some of the videos that you guys have. But just for myself, and I know I talked to you, that's kind of how we got talking, was I showed you my pedal, the Catalyst pedal, and I explained that we've got a lot of the same battle, where people try to make an assumption on what this is going to feel like based on their previous experience. And until you try it, you really can't do that. So just really encourage people to try it, and I don't think that they'll be disappointed. So yeah, any other thoughts on the soft tissue stuff?
No, I think we covered that pretty well. I mean, there's obviously a lot more, but it's just going to get technical and not really add value to the discussion. Those are the tools. Those are how you use it. That's the results you see. I just want people to understand kind of some of the base fundamentals of when to choose different types of methods.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think that getting the soft tissue work, kind of going beyond foam rolling, it's time for us as the fitness industry and just, you know, other, you know, sports to start thinking beyond that. It was great when it came out, but, you know, I like, yeah, you know, there's always,
I'll tell you, this is the first, you walk into like a team like the LA Dodgers, the very first thing on their bench, there's 10 of them actually, very first 10 things on their bench that they're working their multi-million dollar players in their rehab room, boomsticks.
Yep. Yeah. I can see it, man. It's definitely going to be the next thing. You know, in 5 years, everyone's going to be pretending that this is how we always did soft tissue work, and you know, probably be quoting you and forgetting who they learned it from. All those other things. So
that's how it works.
It is, man. So cool. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I don't know if you got a few more minutes. I had two more random questions for you, but
sure.
If you got to run, man, I totally understand.
Nope, good? I'm good. Yeah. Yep.
Okay, cool, man. So I noticed that you like barefoot training. You were walking around barefoot as a fellow barefoot enthusiast myself. I wanted to get your thoughts. What kind of got you into barefoot training, and what do you see as the benefits of trying to, of using barefoot training when you can?
Absolutely. So, the very first piece that we focus on in our priorities is breathing and bracing and control of spinal mechanics. Okay. That has the highest global impact throughout the body. Okay. So you can't start chasing shoulder problems, hip, knee problems until you've like taken care of that first, okay? The very next priority, and a lot of people, more people are talking about it now. I've been preaching this for years. So you can watch all my old videos for years. people are like, oh my God, he's doing it barefoot. And I'm like, yeah, because it's a performance enhancing tool. Like they think it's like some like, you know, like, oh, he's squatting without a belt. I'm like, no, I'm doing it because I squat more. So the very next thing that has the highest global level of importance is the foot. And footwear has had a really destructive impact on how our feet operate. So we have the most bones in our feet is in the body. I can't remember the number of nerves, but it's, I don't know if it's the most, it's, if not, it's right up there. We lose, you know, basically we lose that, that sense of feeling, our ability, the nociception is like improved as soon as you take the foot off. The second thing is so many people have these upstream problems. You talk to anybody in the gym, I got to wear heeled shoes so I can squat to depth because I'm missing dorsiflexion and this knee problem and that hip problem. I can never get to this position without blah, blah, blah. The story goes on and on. And I'm like, do you ever think that maybe it's because you're weak? Like your foot is weak? Because what's going to happen if our foot is weak and not a stable platform? What is the body going to do? The same thing that it's going to do when you're not using the shoulder correctly, right? It's going to start, or the hip correctly. Like I love the squat because people like, oh, you squat, that's got to tighten the hips. I'm like, no, I can damn near do the splits. And I don't stretch. I don't need to. I move well. And they're strong and they function well. Okay? But if I squat like shit, excuse the language, my body's going to try to protect that joint and start tightening up the muscles to surround it to limit their range of motion and reduce the chance for injury. It's a very basic principle. We've built the same system into our vehicles, by the way. If you're driving a car and it's got traction control, when you hit something wet or slippery, it doesn't take the power from the tires that, you know, are slipping and send them to gripping. No, it just reduces the power output and the shift patterns. Our body does the same thing. So that's why it's a performance enhancer. It's going to reduce my power output to protect it. It's going to start tightening the muscles surrounding those joints. So why is my ankle mobility limited? Because I've got a weak foot. The body's trying to protect that next joint that's closest to it, right? And so we could go on, like, I could go on rants for a long time about all the issues that need to happen with the foot and the impacts of it. But it's just an incredibly, you want a strong and functional foot. You want to be able to maintain what is called the foot and ankle stack, to be able to have those stacked over each other. People are worried that, you know, the whole shoe industry has got people, you know, thinking that a flat arch is some sort of, you know, something that's wrong that has to be fixed. No, people have different shaped arches. It's okay. But am I controlling, you know, am I controlling the positions? Am I able to control where that ankle's sitting through my foot? And so if I rely on a shoe with an arch support in there, it becomes a passive modality. You're laying against it to support you versus actively controlling and owning it once you know how. Those are going to have huge differences in the body. I've seen some meta analysis of the use of orthotics. And there is zero long-term evidence that orthotics provide any benefit beyond the first couple months of maybe some relief of pain. But then you got to get back to, like, you know, fixing the problem, owning the positions, being able to control it. So I train barefoot to strengthen my feet and to be able to use my foot. Unfortunately, the gym environment's flat, so we still don't get the piece of actually the foot is meant to move around a lot of things. And so there's some techniques that we have on dealing with foot. Soft tissue stuff is great as well. You saw in our course, we covered using the boomstick on the foot to help with some of this stuff. But I'm a huge believer in barefoot not necessarily that everybody needs to be barefoot, but you need to spend some time out of the shoe. That's it. So spend some time. Make sure that you're getting a shoe that doesn't have a huge heel, doesn't rely on an orthotic arch support, and has a very large toe box to allow the front of the foot to be able to expand. Learn and understand rooting techniques, the 3 points of contact and how we make point of the ground, and making sure that you're able to maintain and control that ankle being stacked over the top of the foot. Some deviation either direction is going to be a little bit okay, but there's a range. And once you go too far, where you're hanging out on the outside or the inside of the foot, we've got a problem. So those are the basic fundamentals.
Yeah, no, man, I love it. What was there, like, was this something you were always into, or was there like somebody who really turned you on to this, or I guess what, what got you into it?
God, I don't know. I was thinking I got turned on to it through DNS, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization, which a lot of our breathing and bracing principles are built off of. And so I know they had an impact on me, but I was realizing, somebody pointed out the other day, they're like, oh yeah, don't you remember you were making custom shoes? I'm like, shit, yeah, I was making like custom shoes like 15 years ago to train in, because I'd rip the soles out, and I was doing all sorts of stuff to try to, because I found that it was improving my performance, until basically around 4 or 5 years ago, I just went barefoot in the gym completely, and barefoot in life for the most part. I mean, I wear flip-flops because they kick on and off really fast, or I wear barefoot style shoes that allow the most amount of movement. You need a shoe. Like, at the end of the day, to protect you from getting cuts, we're not designed to walk around on, 120 degree pavement. There's, communicable, diseases and stuff like that. Like, there's a reason we have shoes, but there's not a reason that we have these overly supported, cushiony, elevated products that are out there, which is hilarious, because they've all these features they built into shoes all start because of the elevated heel. And then they keep having to like fix, oh, now that we got to raise the toe. Oh, we got to get this arch. Like, it's like, how many band-aids can you throw at it before you realize the base design was fucked up? Like,
right. Yes. I can sympathize, man. There's a whole industry in the cycling world. I mean, the bike fit industry in general exists to try to fix a problem, which is, a lot of it stems from a lot of things you're talking about. Because the Catalyst pedal basically was designed, because I'm a huge barefoot trainer as well. It's funny you're talking about. I had the same thing for years, where I'd post a video and I'd be training barefoot, and someone would be like, "Oh my God, you're gonna drop a weight on your toe," and it's like, dude, if you think my shoe is going to protect
me. I know. That's why I love that when people ask that. I'm like, did you see how much weight was on the dumbbell or the bar? Like, if I dropped a plate, you think my tennis shoe is going to stop that 45 pound plate? Like, I, no.
Yeah,
my foot's going to fucking hurt.
I think that's one of the things, like, foot health is one of the things in the cycling industry that is completely overlooked. People use orthotics, clipless pedal shoes. I'm sure you probably, seen those. They're like coffins for your feet with carbon soles. And I mean, they are the antithesis of a functional, healthy environment for your foot. And so, that insight that I had of standing on the ground supports both ends of your arch. And if you create a platform on the bike that does that as well, allows you to support and create pressure on both ends of your arch, then your foot is supported and you can function a lot better. But I'm always interested to kind of hear barefoot people's story, because you're definitely committed to it. You're like me, man. I hate shoes. Like, I have flip flops. I've got some of those Jesus sandals, the ones like the Taru Maru. Have my high performance sandals and some Vivo barefoots, but man, I love, like, just walking around barefoot. It just it's good once you get used to it, but you do have to spend into it a bit.
Yeah, you do. So that's the big problem is people just jump into it, and guess what? It hurts. Your foot's weak. You don't just like walk into the gym and go, squatting is good. Put 500 pounds on the bar. Like, no, you start with 135, and then you progress. Like, it's the same thing. You can't just like go, I'm barefoot, I'm just going to switch over. Like, your foot's weak, huh? You haven't been training it. Like, you got to build into it. Take 10% of your time out of the shoe. Okay.
Yeah.
Do that for a few weeks or a month. then bump it to another 10%. Okay. And people don't, that's where Vibram really hurt the barefoot movement, I think, is they put out a product, rode the wave of it, the high of the novelty and newness, but didn't provide the education to people that, like, no, don't just put these on and because you've been, and go, you know, go run 20 miles.
Right.
Because you've been running 20 miles, but you've been doing it at an elevated heel. Guess what? It's going to mess you up. Like, so
the body will adapt to whatever you're doing to it, good or bad. And so, you know, it's just like if you're using your lower back when you deadlift and somebody shows you how to deadlift properly, you're going to have to cut the weight back. Like, it's just, you know, it's just part of it's the dip, you know, I think is the term for it. You're going to have to go through that little bit of a dip to come out the other side better.
What we do in the training environment is we do all assessments barefoot. So we can actually, because you can see what's happening in the body through what's happening in the foot. So with a shoe on, you can't really tell exactly what's happening. So we do all our assessments barefoot, but then we have people just do some of your accessories, do some of your warm-ups barefoot. You know, if you're still comfortable, you know, if you're not comfortable with that, that's fine. Do this. And then people eventually they just start, well, I went ahead and now I'm just doing everything because they find that it works after time. So, the other, check out, Barefoot Athletics, and that's bear as in, you know, grizzly bear, BEAR, Foot Athletics. So we only have a sock and a shin guard right now. It's a really freaking awesome sock designed specifically to be worn on its own in the gym, with grippers and no like movement on the foot. They're made out of Japan. But we will be getting into shoes and some other stuff. We're in the design phase of that, working with some industry designers that are also barefoot enthusiasts in the background.
But awesome, man.
They're kind of stuck in the industry right now.
yeah, I'll be looking forward to those. But the barefoot athletic. Those socks that you were mentioning, I think are a good option for people that if you work out in a gym where you have to wear some sort of shoes or you're in an environment where wearing something on your feet. Yeah. I've mentioned before, people forget, man, the first monkey that figured out he could strap something to his feet must've seemed like a freaking god to the other monkeys. You know, he could walk across those thorns that no one else could get to. Like, you know, let's not hate on shoes, right? Like shoes are good technology, but they get overused. So, well, cool, man. I had just one last question because I noticed that you guys also have a mace product called the Shoulder Rock. And the mace is something that I got into, man, probably about a little over three years ago. And I've been a huge advocate for it since then. I had some neck and shoulder problems and it helped clear those up. And so I just wanted to, just kind of how you got into the mace training and kind of what your experience and thoughts on that are.
I would love to. The Shoulder Rock is how we launched Kabuki Strength. It's the very first product. And honestly, there was not a mace swinging movement at the time. What we see today is really an output of like the impact that we've had in the industry. I'd messed around with some mace swinging maybe 5 years before that. So about 10 years ago. And I watched some YouTube videos because there was basically no content out there on mace swinging at the time. And I did it, did what I saw people doing on the videos, and my wrists hurt, my elbows hurt. And I'm like, this is no good. So I abandoned it. I actually machined my own ones. And then I came back after learning the DNS principles. I'm like, well, what if I try this mace swinging again? With these, you know, really focusing on ribcage position, inflation through the oblique, like let's put all this stuff together and let me try this mace swinging again. And I went in again. I was like, oh my God, this is just amazing. My shoulder's been hurting to fall asleep, difficulty falling asleep for like 8 years. Pain's gone after a couple weeks of swing, like just gone. It's never come back. And I'm like, oh, this is nice. So I went to another guy in the gym who was another 500-pound bencher. I'm like, you got shoulder pain? He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, I've been having trouble falling asleep every night for a number of years. I'm like, here, try this. Let me coach you on it. A couple weeks later, he's like, my shoulder pain's gone. And I'm like, okay, on to the next person, right? And so then we had them in the gym for probably a couple years, the ones I'd made, and I never released them to market because there's a couple things, like I found, to be effective, there's a longer length that you need to have out there. So it means that you've got to have a lot of different maces to make it work, because with a really long lever, a small amount of weight makes a big difference. So a lot of them out there, just even the ones out there today, are too short. They're better than nothing, but they're just not going to elicit the same effect. And so I wanted to make it loadable using standard gym plates or using gym plates. And but then I was worried about securing it, mechanism, stuff like that, so that plates don't fall off. And ended up going with a reverse loading technique so that inertia keeps it on. So there's literally no way, if somebody doesn't even mount it on there, a plate's not going to swing off and hit somebody in the head. So so basically, mace swinging's the oldest known, loaded training tool that I'm aware of. The Gada out of India is what it's based on. And our shoulder rock is the same length as the classical Gada, except we've modified it for modern techniques to be able to micro load it with plates from a gym. So you only need one. Nice little light knurling on the handle for grip. The end of it, we actually put the same radius that's on our boomstick. So you can actually do your upper, lean it against the floor and like get in and do your pecs or lats and subscap. A lot of your upper body mobility work with it as well. And I launched that 5 years ago at the start of the company. And at the time, nobody was mace swinging, and it was like a whole education piece out there. And now it's awesome to see where it's coming. I'd like to see more people designing them a more appropriate length, because it is an important point, because the long lever allows the balance. It forces you to be able to have to relax to perform the swing, because otherwise we're just kind of mimicking a kettlebell halo. And a kettlebell halo is just like the foam rolling we talked about, right? You're on the whole time, okay? You're just moving it. You're moving in a range of motion, but your muscles are on. And so what we need to do is, move all those muscles or move the shoulder through its entire range of motion while pulsing off all the muscles that support and stabilize that entire shoulder girdle on and off, okay? Because that's pure athleticism. That's Muhammad Ali, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Like, this is the speed to relaxation is related exactly to the speed of contraction as well. So so we're actually training athleticism at the same time, but that's fundamentally the big difference with having it on the proper lever, where you cannot perform the swing without the relaxation phase. And that's important. So it's a quick relax, pulse. And that's where we get these longstanding improvements, because a lot of it, we're dealing with, to oversimplify it, right? Issues with the shoulder, same thing that we talked about with our tight quads on the pelvis, right? So we're trying to, the foot and the ankle, but the wrong muscles are basically hypertonic. They're constantly under tension, trying to stabilize the joint, because the muscles that are supposed to be on stabilizing the joint are not active the way that they should be. So it's not just about getting those. We got to turn things on and off. People always focus on just the off. Okay, so that's where our soft tissue work comes in. So I could go restore range of motion immediately with a boomstick, but I'm not going to deal with the underlying issue, is the right muscles to stabilize the joint aren't on. So it's going to keep happening over and over again. So the shoulder rock deals with both at once. And so that's why we get such a great thing from it. But it's got to be properly designed and used correctly. And it can be an incredible tool.
That's awesome, man. So where did you first come across mace swinging?
So maybe around 2005-ish, and then the current I've been swinging for about 7 years ish now. So it was probably 2 years, at least 2 years before the release of the shoulder rock, that I had that final, you know, that design, and was consistently using it. Yeah.
In 2005, where were you finding it in 2005? You just
I don't remember. I like bounced on some video on YouTube or something like that, you know?
Huh.
So, and it was just like, there was like two videos out there and it was like some, you know, and I'm like, wow, that's freaking cool. I'm like, I think I see some advantage, but I didn't know, there was no information about it. Like there was nothing to go off of, like how to do it right. What made it work? Like any of this stuff. And so, now we've got like, well, several different menus. There's even mace swing. There's people that'll certify you in mace swing. And I'm like, to your point earlier, like people, I'm like, that wasn't even a thing before I launched the shoulder rock. But now, you know, I'm like, fine. I actually hate that stuff because I hate people that, because those people are like, the mace is everything. Like it's all of the only training tool that you need. I'm like, no, it's an incredible training tool. But you need other things. Like it's, it has a purpose and a specific use, and it's incredible for it. Don't freaking gussy it up and say it's the thing for everything and replace everything else. You know, just like, you know, the kettlebell fanatics and the, you know, like you're great. Yeah. I use them a lot, but it's not the only training, you know, method. So,
yeah.
So I've stayed away from that. We sell our product, we do our education, and we teach the basic movements. We don't teach like the million different things that these mace swinging gurus do. You know, but that's what they're doing. And,
it is one of those tools that you can definitely do a lot with, but the swings, the 360s, the 10 and twos, Dan John, go ahead.
So there's some offset load, rotational type stuff that I'll do with it. That's really great for stimulating those cross patterns of stabilization, from hip to shoulder to, you know, shoulder, hip to foot and so on, that are absolutely fantastic. But like, it's not an everything tool.
Right. Yeah. No, you have a couple things that you can do with it that you can't do with any other tool that make having that tool worth it. You can't, you know, you need a good mace to do that stuff with. And so, it isn't everything. It should be part of the toolbox, not the toolbox. So, I totally agree with that. That's, it's funny, man. I was reading Natural Born Heroes. And Steve Maxwell was actually talking about like the gata, and he referred to it like upper body jump rope. And that got me thinking like, well, if you ever try to jump rope with bad posture, you can't do it. And so, you know, I was thinking like, wow, okay, well, if it's upper body jump rope, like it's going to force me to have good posture. Like if I'm going to do it properly and get that bounce and not like that halo, like you were talking about. I kind of naturally fell on a lot of those things, and it's been a great tool. Like I said, I've been a huge advocate for it. I think the leverage
huge, great. You need to be pimping that amongst cyclists. I mean, that's huge for the issues you guys got going on. Yeah.
Yep. Upper body, the shoulder, the other thing that works is the grip strength. Like you were talking about, it's like grip strength on a bike. It's a pulsing, you know, it's being able to relax and then turn on when you need and relax. Yep. And so the mace teaches you that. So there's a lot that comes from it. But I like your guys' tool. I can attest to, I have a lot of the kind of more standard available maces. If you know how to do a swing properly, you can do it, but you can get away with a bad one. But I had a buddy who made me a custom one that's got like the long handle. And like you said, like, you have to do it right.
It's a different, it honestly is like, they're like, it's the same. It's, I'm like, no, just try it with a longer handle. If you want to make your own, that's fine. I recommend between 45 to 49 inches.
Yeah.
It makes fantastic. Unfortunately, everybody's designing in around 36. And there's a reason they do that. Because they don't want to have, if they make it longer, because they're fixed weights, they're going to have to tell you that you need to buy 10 of them. And that doesn't make a very good sales position. So that's why they, A shorter doesn't have as much differences between those weights that a long one does. So there's a reason they do it, but it's working around the fact it's not designed the right length. So.
Yep. No. Whenever the industry gets a hold of something good, man, gotta be careful. So yeah, refer people back to you. I did not realize that you guys were kind of the originator of the, you know, popularization of the swinging, you know, the mace movement. So that's pretty cool, man. I appreciate the work you did with that. So cool. Yeah. Well, I guess that was my last random question for you, man. I don't really have anything else. We've gone way over the time. I told you, I really appreciate all of your time and the information that you shared. But yeah, is there anything else you want to share with us before we go?
I think it's time for me to get to some training, actually.
Yeah. Right on, brother. So I want to, everybody can check you guys out at kabukistrength.com. I'll link to all of your Instagram stuff with this podcast. Your book, The Eagle and the Dragon, people can find it on Amazon, and again, highly recommend that. But yeah, guys, check out these guys. They're doing a lot of great stuff. Get you a boomstick, get you an AccuMobility ball, start earning that right to train tomorrow. And Chris, I really appreciate all your time.
Been fantastic.
Thanks, buddy.